This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Welcome back to the program. So to come, top of the hour, we'll talk to Aaron Ambrose from Team Canada. Thrilling 6-5 overtime victory yesterday against the United States in Utica at the Women's World Championships. Also, Jesse Granger, the bottom of the hour from The Athletic, talking about the Vegas Golden Knights. In the meantime, our next guest is Jim Nill. He's a general manager, of course, of the Dallas Stars. Top team in the ultra-competitive Central Division and look poised to do some damage in the playoffs. Jim Nill joins me now. Jim, how are you today? Thanks so much for doing this.
Yeah, hi, Jeff. It's great to be on your show. Thanks for having me.
Oh, the pleasure is all ours here. Trust me. Curious, as the season winds down here and, you know, we head into the postseason, your team distinguishes itself as the top dog in the Central Division. All season long, you know, we wondered, you know, which one was going to pull away from the pack, and it's your Dallas Stars. I don't know if you set expectations for the regular season or you just look at the season as a whole and you'll judge it at the end, but if you divide it into regular season and postseason, post-regular season playoffs, what were your expectations for the regular season for this team based on what you saw at training camp?
Well, it's, you know, it's a long year. The regular season is a grind, the same 2-year schedule, and a lot of factors come into play. You know, there's injuries, there's schedules, there's travel, all things and stuff. And our biggest thing is we just want to be consistent all year. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're pretty proud of the coaches and the players and the staff, medical staff and everybody else. We've been very consistent. You know, we haven't had any big 5-7 game losing streaks. I think we've lost 3 in a row once, and that was it. And there were some overtime losses in that. So we really, whenever I was a little bit worried that the train maybe coming off the tracks, you know, just you get into that February grind and stuff, our guys always buckle down at the right time. And it didn't matter whether we had injuries or whatever. And so it's been a good year that year. They've been very consistent. And it's, you mentioned it, the league is so close. You know, we're in the mix, but there's a lot of other good teams. And we'll start the playoffs up and let's see where we fall.
Really good teams right around you in the Central Division in Winnipeg and the Colorado Avalanche. I want to drill down on a couple of players, but before I get there, I want to ask you about Peter DeBoer, your head coach. I've always marveled at how he handles his bench, how he handles the forwards specifically. You know, nobody is into the 20-minute range for time on ice, and also no one's in single digits either. Like, it's a very even-handed way to run the bench. And, you know, now you look at the 20-goal scorers and a couple of 30-goal scorers on the Dallas Stars, you know, it kind of has us thinking back to that, I think it was the 78 Boston Bruins team that had, I think it was 11 players hitting 20 goals, set the NHL record. When you look at how your coach handles his bench, and you've been there with a lot of different coaches in the NHL, what do you make of how Pete does it?
Well, first of all, you talk 1978, Jeff. Were you even born then?
I was. I'm 54, Jim. I was. I was just learning the NHL and who are these Boston Bruins and who's this guy with the wild suits behind the Boston Bruins bench. Oh, it's Don Cherry.
That was my favorite team actually growing up. But when Pete and I in the last season we sat down and we discussed how we're going to build the team moving forward for this season, and that was the big thing he wanted. He wanted 4 lines that he could really roll all the time, spread out the ice time. You know, and because of that, you know, there's got to be a buy-in from the players. They have to understand, some of these high-end guys, you might be missing some ice time, which can turn into points sometimes. But our players all bought into it, and I think it's a big advantage for us. You know, we're pretty fresh all the time. We talked about the 82-game grind, and I think that was one of the reasons that we could get through some tough times is, on back-to-backs, and that is we're always pretty fresh with the 4 lines. So that was kind of the plan going in, and it's worked out well for us. We're fortunate through free agency to add some good players, Matt Duchene and Craig Smith and young kids coming up like Logan Stankoven and Wyatt Johnson took another step. So it really kind of worked out the way we were hoping it was going to be, and I think it's been a big advantage for us.
But I want to ask you about Wyatt Johnston here because, I mean, what a season for this young man and what an encore season. A great season last year and follows it up with this one. And I want to go back to that draft where you flipped picks with the Detroit Red Wings and ended up taking Wyatt Johnston. Did you make that move with the knowledge or the suspicion that, A, you wanted the player, and, B, if you made this move, he would still be there?
Yeah, we had, lots of discussions that year. And a lot of different circumstances took place because of that year. Because of the COVID year, the OHL was shut down.
Yes.
Great discussions with Joe McInnell, my head of amateur scouting, and we sat down and we talked about why it was the guy he wanted. He was adamant. Mm. And I challenged him on it. He was adamant that why it was the guy where we were picking, he'd be the guy that we wanted. And we went through the scenarios, how far could we go down? And Joe was pretty comfortable, for people that don't know, Wyatt only played 7 games that year.
Yep.
So it's not like he was seen by everybody, but Joe had seen enough of him as an underage and caught him a little bit at the under-18s where he played 7 games and was very comfortable with the pick. He just, your scouting staff has certain gut feel, and Joe had a gut feel. He said, Jim, this is a guy. So we discussed, how far could we move down, and he was pretty comfortable if we could get down to the early 20s that we'd still get him just because, he really wasn't seen, and Joe was right. So we did make that move knowing that we had a pretty good, you never know, you're gambling a little bit, but it was an opportunity to grab another pick, which actually turned out well, which turns into Logan Stankoven. So it was kind of a double whammy for us, so it worked out well.
There's been a couple of drafts where you've really set the franchise up for long-term success. Let me swing back on one question about Pete DeBoer. Come trade deadline time, even before trade deadline time, how often do you talk to your coach about needs for the playoffs, players that, Pete is protective of, like, okay, hands up. Like, what are the things you've done this year? I mean, you've really helped this team and you haven't touched the lineup. It's really been impressive, and we'll get to the Tanev deal in a second year. But how much conversation would you have with Pete about what he needed, what he wanted for the playoffs?
Well, we're in discussions all the time. And, Pete wants to win. His job is to put the best team on the ice that we can. So he's pushing those buttons. And so we talked about who was available and stuff. We knew we had to add to our back end. That was kind of one of the things we wanted to see. We're pretty fortunate. I mean, we started this season and we didn't know where Thomas Harley and Nils Lundqvist and some of these younger guys were going to be. And it turned out Thomas Harley took a big, big step, and Nils had a good season. So we were comfortable with that, but we knew we needed to add another defenseman, just needed for the playoffs. And that's where we're fortunate. We'll talk with the Tanev trade probably later with you. But that was kind of the plan, and it worked out well for us. But Pete, he's very involved. In the end, he's got to make the final call in the lineup. I'm not going down there and saying, here's who you have to play. That's his role, and that's what I've hired him for, and he makes that final call. So we're in constant communication as far as the lineup and the depth of the organization.
You mentioned Thomas Harley a second ago. I really believe that the NHL, much like the NBA, the NHL should have a most improved player award, and generally it should focus around some of the younger players that have taken that next step, the Quinton Byfields, the Seth Jarvis, et cetera. Thomas Harley's right in there in that conversation. Like, when you look around the NHL, and there's a few, like Yuri Slavkovsky in Montreal, there's another one. When you look around the NHL and you look at most improved young players, Thomas Harley's right there in that mix. I know he doesn't get the headlines that Byfield does, Seth Jarvis, Yuri Slavkovsky, but I'd put your guy right in that mix. At what point did you realize, hold on a second here, Thomas Harley has taken a major, major step this season?
Well, we started to see it about 20 games in. Back up a little bit. He was kind of one of those players, once again, unfortunately, because of COVID, was caught in one of those years where his final junior year didn't play. He came to the bubble with us in Edmonton, spent time with us, but didn't play. So he was up with a big team. He was on the bubble. We had him up even on that kind of that second bubble year we had. He was up with the team but not playing a lot of games. And so when it finally came time, when we got back to a little normalcy in our lives, we sent him down to the minors. And it's not easy. You've been up with a big team for, a year and a half under different circumstances. And, it's a pretty good lifestyle, and life's pretty good, but it doesn't help a young player's development. And that's where I give a lot of accolades and respect to Thomas. Was he happy to go down? No. We explained it to him. But in the end, when it was all said and done, he was the first guy that came up to me and said, you know what, Jim, you were right. It was the best thing for me. He loved it. He had a great year down there. The coaching staff or development staff down in Austin, Texas, where our farm team is, did a great job developing him. He bought into having to be better defensively, not just being an offensive guy. And Dad has paid off in spades for us now. He's come up, and he's a top three defenseman in the NHL now at a young age.
He really has been exceptional. Let me ask you this as a quick sidebar right now to this year's edition of the Dallas Stars. I mean, I'm just curious. That Connor Punnett kid that you signed from the Oshawa Generals, I'm a huge fan, and B, I'm wondering if he got on your radar at the Traverse City camp when, to be blunt, he beat the brakes off Grushnikov, who you ended up moving for Chris Tanev. Was that the moment that Jim Nill and the Dallas Stars kind of all went, ooh, let's see if we can get our hands on this?
Well, he's a little bit of a something we don't have in our organization. You know, we've got a lot of skilled guys. We've our back end, you know, top of Thomas Harley, these guys have all moved up, and you know, we've drafted some skilled defensemen, and he's a little bit of a unicorn that way. He plays hard. He's got a physical presence to him. So our scouts really started to watch him. Over the last 2 years, they've been watching him pretty close, and this year he really took off. And so he was kind of a priority for us to get signed. We're fortunate to sign him, but he's really going to add something different that we don't have a lot. We got Liam Bischel, who's a lot like him, but having him adds another guy. So it's a perfect fit for us, and I think it's a good fit for him for opportunity-wise.
You know, and you mentioned Liam Bischel here a couple of seconds ago, and listen, we all know the story of Maverick Bork, and you know, there's another one that's coming too, and Logan Stankoven, that story is getting well told too. Like, how do you look at this team? Like, do you look at it in terms of, you know, windows, and now these players are at this point in their career and this opens up another window for X amount of years? Because I'll be honest with you, I'm not the only one who's remarked on this. Like, when we look at the Dallas Stars now and we look at the youth that's on the team and the players that are still coming, like, it looks like, you know, at every turn, Dallas is opening more and more windows. Do you look at it that way?
Well, I looked at it about, I came here in 2013, and we had a pretty good run for about 4 or 5 years. You know, Jamie Benn was starting to come. You know, he became an Olympian and an all-star, won the scoring race. We traded for Tyler Seguin, traded for Spezza, picked up Patrick Sharp, Alex Hemsky. So we kind of patched it together pretty good, and we had a pretty good run for a couple of, you know, 3-4 years. But then that was starting to go down a little bit, and, you know, Sagans and Benz and stuff are starting to get into their 30s, and I was getting a little bit worried what direction we're going to go. Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, buckled down, and our scouting staff did a great job. We hit a couple home runs in the draft. You know, we had that draft year where we, 2017, I believe it is, when we got Miro Heiskanen, Ottinger, and Robertson, and that kind of injected some fuel into us. Rupe Hintz had been drafted a year or two before that. He started to make it. Esa Lindell was stepping into it. So we had a push of guys that really came in and changed it. And all of a sudden, now we've had another push. And it's the Thomas Harleys, it's the Maverick Borks, the Logan Stankovens, then all these young kids that have come in, Liam Bischel. Mm-hmm. And so we've got another good push here. So we think we're set up for the next 3 to 5 years pretty good here. You know, these young kids coming in, and they're not just bodies. They're pretty impactful players, which you have to have. So pretty fortunate. Like I said, our scouting staff did a great job, and they probably saved us from going into one of those mini rebuilds. We didn't really have to dip down too far, and it's really kind of put our team over the top that way.
You don't have to trade first-round picks when everything's coming up from the American Hockey League to fill holes. Last one for you, Jim. Finish this sentence for me, speaking to Jim Nill, Dallas Stars general manager. We will be successful in the playoffs if blank occurs.
Well, you know, everybody's goal is to win the Stanley Cup, but I've been around long enough to know how hard it is to win it. A lot of things have to go right. Yeah. So we've had a great regular season here. Let's go have a good playoff. There's a lot of good teams out there, and I respect these other teams we're playing against, but let's have just a successful run. Let's play. If we play our game the way we can, I know we're going to have some success. Let's let the chips fall, go from there. So I didn't really finish the sentence very well, but it's a
that's
long
okay. That's that was some good stick handling as well. Toe drag between the legs, that was good. Head fake, all of it, Jim. Well done. Jim Nill, the general manager of the Dallas Stars. Jim, thanks as always. Best of luck in the postseason.
Yeah, thanks a lot. You take care, Jeff.
All bye-bye. Right, there he is, Jim Nill, the GM of the Dallas Stars. One of, if maybe, Matty Marchese, the most balanced team heading into the playoffs. When you look at scoring, like this line, this team goes three lines deep, Matty. And then all of a sudden you run into a player like Radek Faksa, who a lot of teams have been calling for and asking about. I know Vegas at various times has tried to get Faksa as well. And now more so than ever with, you know, Pete DeBoer, Kitchener Rangers, Steve Spott, Kitchener Rangers on the bench there. There's no way they're going to let Radek Faksa, Kitchener Rangers, go anywhere. Anyhow, time now for Line Change, presented by Sports Interaction, your homegrown sports book. Bet local. What are you thinking about tonight?
I couldn't even come up with good jokes about, oh, we should do this game or we should do that game, because every game has implications tonight, which is great. But yeah, I'm looking at the Bruins at the Capitals. Puck line is Bruins -1.5. Boston 5-1 straight up in their last six in Washington, and 9-3 straight up in their last 12 overall against the Caps. Washington 2-7 straight up in their last nine at home. It has not been pretty for the Capitals in their barn.
But they're in a wild card two spot. They're in WC2 right now. And you know, one of the jaw dropping things is, I don't know how many teams make the playoffs and they have a goal differential of, checks notes, -40.
That's not good, right?
No. -40. And right now they're in the wild card position with 87 points. Two games left. They have the Boston Bruins tonight, and tomorrow they'll face off against the Philadelphia Flyers. And that is the Flyers' last game of the season. Did I mention they're -40 this year on the season so far? I know we tend to focus on, it's almost as if they win all of their games by one goal, but lose all of their games by five.
Yeah.
Like, that's the way it feels for the Washington Capitals. Charlie Lindgren is not going to get a lot of Hart Trophy consideration, but he really should. Like, one of the main reasons, maybe the main reason why the Charlie Lindgren's in conversation here and the Washington Capitals are in conversation for a playoff spot is because of Charlie Lindgren. 9.09 save percentage, five shutouts so far this season. The Washington Capitals coming off a 4-2 win over the Tampa Bay Lightning. Scary scene with Nick Jensen and Michael Eastmont. That was a tough one to watch. Sonny Milano with a pair on that one. And Boston Bruins shooting for tops in the Atlantic tonight. Should be a great game. And that's Line Change, presented by Sports Interaction, your homegrown sports book. Bet local. When we come back after the break, you'll hear from Erin Ambrose. She's an Olympic champion. She's a multi-time world champion as well, one of the best defenders in the game. She will drop by to talk to us about a thrilling 6-5. There it is, the Canadian score, 72-87. There it is, 6-5. Win over Team USA yesterday in Utica at the World Hockey Championships. Also, Jesse Granger from The Athletic will catch us up on the Mark Stone drama and the Mark Stone sidebar and what's happening with Alex Pietrangelo and the Vegas Golden Knights after their big come-from-behind victory over the Colorado Avalanche yesterday. Merrick Show continues, Sportsnet Radio Network, Sportsnet 360, and wherever you get your podcasts. Here comes Hour 2.
In-depth Blue Jays coverage with an analytical twist. Jays Talk Plus with Blake Murphy. Be sure to subscribe and download Jays Talk on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
There we go. New studio, I got to learn where all the buttons work, Matty, or where they all the buttons are now. Okay. All right, here we go. Welcome back to the program. Welcome to Hour 2 of the show. Standing by for Erin Ambrose, one of the best defenders in the game. How about that, Matty? 6-5 is the final because, of course, that is the Canadian score, as we like to say. That is 1972. Henderson takes a wild stab at it. That is 1987. That is Gretzky to Lemieux. And that was last night. In a thrilling 6-5 victory for Team Canada, Ellis Shelton, like, saved the game at the end with that stick on the goal line, pulling the puck away, to say nothing of Sarah Nurse in the dying seconds as well, blocking a shot. Now, are you a fan of the 3-on-3 overtime?
I am. I mean, the women's game hasn't been ruined by coaches yet with the overtime, because that was actually a lot of fun going back and forth, which I thought was great. I mean, with everything that happened, like, even, you know, Marie-Philippe Poulin going in on the breakaway, you're like, okay, it's over, right?
That's what we all thought. Like, thought the same thing. Over. We're all thinking, 29's on a breakaway. This thing is over. Forget about it. And then she whistles it high.
Yeah.
Like, she loves that high. I mean, she's won a world championship scoring that goal before.
Yep.
On a breakaway, and we're like, okay, it's Marie-Philippe Poulin. It's high glove, high glove, high glove. Sails it over the net.
And then it went back the other way, and the U.S. had a great chance, and then it comes back, and you're like, 2-on-0, defenseman falls. We're like, oh, okay. It's got to be over, 2-on-0, right?
Nope.
Frankel makes an absolutely marvelous save. And then you're saying, oh, boy, everybody's up the ice.
Yep.
Something's going to happen. And then I see the puck go around.
Start counting players.
Too many players on the ice, and I'm going, hold on a second. Wait a tick.
Yeah.
And then that was it. Although the way Canada was going on that power play, I thought that they were going to end it early. And then I'm like, maybe the U.S. is going to hold off here. It was a fantastic overtime. It was very entertaining.
Danielle Serdachny is the 22-year-old from Edmonton who got the game-winning goal yesterday as Canada wins. And it did feel like very much, and we've started to see this the last little while, that we're starting to see more of the younger Sarah Filliet for Canada. Carolyn Harvey for the United States was fantastic. But Danielle Serdachny, with the overtime winner, sending Canada to glory in, as I mentioned, the Canadian score, 6-5. Aaron Ambrose, defender for Team Canada and PWHL Montreal, joins me now. Hello, Aaron Ambrose. How are you feeling today?
I am feeling wonderful. The sun is shining. Got a gold medal around my neck. Beautiful drive back from Utica, New York. Things couldn't be better.
Okay, well, that's awesome. And now you're driving with Anne-Renée Desbiens as well, a gold medal netminder with Team Canada. That was, you know, I was making the point, and I'm sure you've heard this from other people as well, like that's the Canadian score, 6-5. That is, you know, the final games in at Luzhniki Ice Palace in 1972 with Paul Henderson. That is 1987 Canada Cup. And that is your final yesterday. You got the opening goal of the game for Team Canada, and you close it with an assist on the Serdachny goal as well. Like, from your goal to the closing goal in overtime yesterday, like, I can't think of a game that I've seen recently, either, you know, PWHL or World Championships or NHL or anywhere, that had that many, you know, ebbs and flows and crescendos and peaks and valleys. I mean, I'm with my family, and we're all watching this thing yesterday, and it's this, like, roller coaster of emotion, and we just have to be sitting on the couch watching it. I can't imagine what it was like to play in a game like that, and how do you not get caught up in the emotion with everybody on the bench, the highs and the lows and the lead changes and the block shots and Shelton's pulling a puck off the line and Nurse makes a big save at the end to keep it 5-5 to go to OT. How do you manage your emotions there?
You come down from a pretty big high this morning. That's for sure. I feel like I haven't even processed everything that happened. You talked about the lead changes and it was insane. Like, I remember, I think I went back out or started the next shift 3 times after they scored, and the USA chants were loud as could be, but it was just like, how do we shut this crowd up? I think you look at, I mean, I'll probably talk a lot about her, but Marie-Philippe Poulin and her goal at the end of the second period, like, we did not play well in that second period. To the third, kind of go into the dressing room and reset. With her scoring that goal late was huge for us, I think, to be able to kind of take a deep breath. But you definitely had to ride the wave, whether it was going up or going down, and just kind of take it all as it happened and try to just stick with it. And I think that we did a really good job at that.
Let me ask you about Marie-Philippe Poulin yesterday, because it seemed as if, well, first of all, did you think that was a penalty?
No.
Okay.
Definitely not.
So, but it seemed like after that penalty, she came out more determined to take over the entire game. Like, it was almost like the Marie-Philippe Poulin switch went off and she said, you know, enough of this. I'm taking this over. I'm going to end this thing. Did you all feel that on the bench?
I'm not going to lie. I've been kind of scrolling on social media on this drive, and there's the close-up of her after Nider scored on that power play.
Yeah.
And it was like Pooh said, like, you know that she takes everything that happens, whether it was a penalty or not. That lit her up in the penalty box to be in there when Nider scored. So I think you just see she's just built different. Like, there's no words to put it in, or there are no words, because she has the ability to just have the composure to settle us down. The thing she says in the room, like, the girl just gets it. And I mean, I thought for sure that was going to be a storybook ending with Pooh scoring on that breakaway. But even her coming back to the bench, it was just like, you knew that she was mad that she missed it, but we all knew, like, that we were still going to get those opportunities. And I think that when we have a leader like that, like, there's no betting against us because we have Marie-Philippe Flynn, and you know she's going to make things happen.
When she was on that breakaway, did it not feel like the World Championships for a couple of years ago, where it's going to be high glove ends it, and here we go again? It's going to be the copycat goal, and once again, 29 is, you know, she's already like the clutchiest player that ever clutched in any hockey league, whether it's, you know, male, female, animal, vegetable, whatever. She's already the most clutch player the game has ever seen. Did you not think, here we go, here comes another chapter?
Yeah, I mean, as soon as it was probably the longest breakaway I've ever seen. Anne said it today in the car. She goes, it was from my crease, I think. And you saw the replay. She had that opening. She just kind of missed her spot. But even not kind of burying that one, like her late goal to give us the lead late in the game. And like I said, that goal at the end of the second period, I think, was more clutch than people know and people realize.
There, in a game like that, and I know you're with Anne-Renee Debien right now, and she can, you know, probably speak with greater authority than either of us on this one, as she's the goaltender. There's a couple of moments that, as you look back and you see, like, okay, the game could have changed here, the game could have changed there. Shelton pulling the puck off the line. I know that I wouldn't have the hands to do that. I don't know how many players would have, like, the poise. I'd bump it in. Like, right away, I know I would knock that puck in, like, all day, every single day. And a lot of players, I think, looked at that. A lot of people looked at that and said, you know, sneakily, that is such an elite play to make. And then there's Sarah Nurse going down to block one to keep this thing tied at 5 yesterday. Like, when you think of all the ways that this game could have turned and turned against Canada, like, have you, I know this is, like, still fresh in your mind, you're just coming off the win, but have you thought about all the different spots where this thing maybe could have had a different outcome?
Yeah, I think, I like you said, it's still very fresh and haven't kind of dissected everything, but exactly like you said, there were so many different things. Anne had a huge pad save in OT on Harvey on the wraparound, and that was, I definitely gasped on the bench on that one. but, like, those are just things, like, we knew we were going to get the big save from Anne when we needed it, and she gave it to us, and I think for us, it was just, like I said, trying to ride the wave whenever we could, but I think, like, they had some shifts late at the end of the third period where we got stuck out. And even before Pooh's goal in the second, Renata and Joss probably had a 3.5-minute shift. And Turnbull and Clark, you were out there for a while, too. Spooner was out there. And we somehow managed to kind of stay afloat. And then Pooh went down and scored, like, right after that. And it was just, like, those things, like, once you kind of get through those ones that are, you're getting hemmed in, you're kind of just holding on, trying to grind it out. And I think we had the ability to do that yesterday, whether it was a save from Anne or just a simple play and a chip out or a big block shot. I think all three, Nursey, Dax, and Renata, were all on their stomachs blocking that shot at the end. And I think that those are things that win you championships at the end of the day.
Let me, I want to get back to the game here in a second. I want to ask about your sequence on the overtime winner. And I want to ask you about Danielle Sardakny as well. But this is the first, I mean, this is the first, like, to be blunt, this is the first World Championship since the PWHL started. And I think one of the things that we thought about was, okay, so there's a lot of, like, Americans and Canadians mixing with teams and all that. And listen, I think, like, hardcore hockey fans, you know, loves the intense hockey hatred between these two teams. The games are so emotional because of it. And I think a lot of us wondered, was it going to be different? You know, was there going to be, you know, would the athletes be able to bring out, you know, the animosity that they've had for one another forever now that they're mixing in this, you know, elite level women's league? Was that ever a concern for Team Canada? Like, could you get the hate up enough for the Americans?
I don't think it's ever a concern. I think it's kind of, I don't know how we have the ability to do it sometimes, but I mean, you look at the round robin game and that was the most entertaining 1-0 game I've ever been a part of. People say that it was the fastest, most physical game that they've seen Canada and the U.S. play, and I think that just shows you, like, it's still very much there. There's a lot of hatred. But I think there's just a newfound level of respect, too, and we know that in order to beat them, like, we have to be at our best. We know that what we've done to create this new league, to create such a great environment for us to train and play in all the time. We've done it together. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, as soon as we are representing our countries, there is a lot of hatred.
Let me ask you about the officiating and the officiating around one thing specifically. And this relates to the PWHL specifically. One of the things that everybody has remarked upon with the PWHL is just how rough it is and how the hits are for keeps. And a lot of people aren't used to seeing that. And on the international stage, the IIHF has a different standard for how they handle body checking. Generally, the loose rule is if you hit too hard, you're going to sit down and they're going to call it charging or whatever. Now, in this tournament, I'll tell you, there were a number of moments just having watched, you know, women's international hockey for long as I have, there were some pretty big collisions. And listen, I'm with you. I don't think the Marie-Philippe Poulin penalty should have been a penalty, but nonetheless, like, there were other collisions in the game and other body checks in the game that I'm quite used to seeing called, and they weren't this time around. And I can't help but thinking that's a reflection of the PWHL, and that's a PWHL pushing the physical line and pushing the physical boundary out even farther. Did you feel that as players? Because you've played in a number of international tournaments, and you know what the standard for contact has always been. Did it feel like you had more leeway in this tournament?
I think so. I think I'm shockingly going to give a compliment to the officials and saying, like, I think they did a pretty good job. Anne and I were talking about it in the car today. Just, like, they didn't insert themselves in the game yesterday. That wasn't a penalty, but they hadn't made too many of those calls. And then you kind of look at what was called, like, even the penalty in overtime, it's like, okay, yeah, it's tough to get a penalty in overtime, but at the same time, like, they had four players on the ice. Like, that's one you're not going to not call in overtime. Yeah. So I think it allowed us to play our game and it allowed us to play the game in order to show what we had and to make sure that we were making the impact 5-on-5. And it was, mm-hmm. I mean, it was entertaining as could be, even without a ton of special teams. So for us to be able to go out and do that without the special teams and then obviously pulling through with a power play goal is huge for us.
With Aaron Ambrose, Team Canada defender, successful yesterday, Canada over USA 6-5, the Women's World Championships in Utica. How do you feel about 3-on-3 overtime as opposed to 5-on-5 overtime?
I like it. I appreciate that it's endless. Like, I think, like, we're going to go 3-on-3 until there is a winner. And I think for me, I'd much rather 3-on-3 than any type of shootout. I think that just allows at least a game to be played still and not just complete skill. But at the same time, like, I just think 5-on-5, like, I mean, obviously yesterday there were enough goals scored that it probably wouldn't have lasted too long, 5-on-5. But yeah. I think 3-on-3 just allows a lot more to happen. And it's not that we needed an extra entertainment level, but we reached another one with 3-on-3, that's for sure.
You really did. Walk us through the sequence. You have the puck at the point, you cut to the middle to shoot. Next thing you know, all arms are raised, and a 22-year-old from Edmonton becomes a star.
I think you just walked us right through it, Jeff. I actually think, though, something that's overlooked is Dax's entry. She slipped the puck into me in the middle. So before I even kind of got to shoot that puck, the entry was huge because U.S. had numbers on us at the line as we were kind of changing. And I just tried to kind of settle it down. I knew we had a little bit of time left, but not a ton of time on the power play. And we had put a lot of emphasis on in the whole tournament, Guy shooting the puck, but also our forwards being net front. And Dax went there. Unfortunately, I pegged her with a shot, but it ended up being okay because it bounced right to her stick.
Considering all the shots that you've absorbed in your career, and I know what a lot of the injuries you've sustained blocking shots, I don't think you should feel bad if one of your shots hits someone else. A couple things quickly. Danielle Sardakny, as I mentioned, becomes the hero in this one. Like, listen, we all know the Sarah Filliere story now and how much of a star she already is and is going to be even brighter when she joins the PWHL. What do you think we should know about Danielle Sardakny?
I think she's just getting started. I think for her, like, it was great that she got the experience last year at Worlds. I think she kind of got her feet wet. But you look at the way that she entered into the senior program, and Her first ever event was Rivalry Series. She scores the OT winner there.
Yeah.
So the kid has it. She knows what to do. I think I love her size. Her size and her physicality, I think, like, that fourth line was the best line we've had in a long time. And, I mean, Dax gets the goal in overtime. Julia gets the goal during regulation time. So I think just them being able to do that, and O'Neill had a phenomenal tournament for us. So I think with Dax, like, the sky is the limit for her. She's going to continue to kind of process things at higher speeds. And
right.
her skill, it's unbelievable. Like I said, that slip pass to kind of even get us into that zone. And even to know that on that play, like, her back's to Frankel, but she knows she's kind of scrambling. And I think just that, push that in right away. She's not even facing her and not trying to take more time than she had. It was pretty special.
Let me ask you about the trophy pass. I'm always curious about this one. Listen, I know how close you are with Sarah Nurse, so no surprise that, you know, Sarah Nurse, after her circle, passed the cup to you, and then you passed it to Ella Shelton. Is there anything we should read into either events?
Well, I mean, I was quite happy that my best friend got to pass me that trophy, and then giving it to Ella was pretty special. I've played with Claire Thompson in the past, and she wasn't there, and I thought Ella's been the best defenseman in the PWHL this year. The way that she can shoot the puck, the way that she sees the game, she makes my life out there a lot easier with how well she communicates, and I think the best part about her is she's so good at both ends of the ice. So she was surprised when I went over to her to pass the trophy, but Shelton deserved that one, and Shelton had a great tournament.
Last one for you, Aaron. We'll let you get back to your drive from Utica to Montreal. Last one for you. Is this one different? I mean, you've been successful on the international stage in a lot of different tournaments, whether it's Olympics, whether it's World Championships. You mentioned the Rivalry Series, and boy, this year's edition of Rivalry Series was awesome. Was this one different in any way, shape, or form, and if so, how?
I think they all are, Jeff. And I think the best part about this one is just, I feel like I say it every time, but the group that we had, like, we were a bunch of hooligans in the room and just had so much fun, and that's when we're at our best. The weird stuff that we do is the best part about it all, and I think that we were at a Turning Stone Resort in Verona, New York, half an hour from the rink, and we made every bit of it worth it. So I think it's pretty special to kind of have that and have those memories now, and it just feels so good to be back on top. And I think it does feel different in the sense of coming off that loss last year in Brampton and being able to kind of reclaim it and take it back home.
Okay, last one for you. Who wore the lampshade at the party after the big win last night? And if you can't tell us who her name is, what does her name rhyme with?
we're just gonna go with JLR. You can figure that one out.
JLR.
JLR is she's the best. There's no space bars needed to be able to kind of put it any more than that. It's Ratty's life, and we're all living in it.
Ratty scores goals. Ratty scores goals,
and
Ratty enjoys herself, and Ratty's awesome. Listen, congratulations. Yeah. Looks great on you. Looks great on the entire program. Looks great on your team, your colleagues, your friends, everybody. And now back to Montreal and PWHL, and we'll check in regularly down the stretch. Thanks so much, Aaron, and congrats.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you very much.
There she is, Aaron Ambrose, number 23, on the blue line. She opened the scoring yesterday in the World Championship gold medal game, or the World Championship final game, and got an assist on the final goal by Danielle Serdakny. It feels very much like the beginning of the change over here. We didn't even mention Layla Edwards, who was an absolute force, plays at Wisconsin, and she's 6'2" and strong and so good. And mentioned Carolyn Harvey as well, who was fantastic and dynamic and such a great skater and is going to be a presence for a lot of years. In women's hockey, congratulations to Team Canada. 6-5 yesterday is the victory, and Canada wins and claim gold at the World Hockey Championships. Hey, Maddie.
Danielle Serdakny, I looked it up, of course,
yeah.
Because I don't have this knowledge on hand. And then I was like, God, that last name sounds oddly familiar, doesn't it? And as we know, her father, Steve Cerdakny.
Steve Cerdakny.
So she's a good skater for a reason.
Yes. But you know what, though? It's funny, too, because you mentioned good skater. I look at when I go to, like OHL games, but before that, you know, you look around the NHL and go to practices and you know, go to PWHL games or PWHL practices or watch the World Championships. You know what's gone? The bad skaters. Everybody skates.
Yep.
Like everyone, like you can't play hockey now unless you skate and you see it. You know, one of the things, too, about this World Championship, and we thought this would happen with the creation of the PWHL, and even if it's in its infancy right now, like you can already see the skill level at the international level take a step and take a bump. And this is just going to have a compounding effect on all of women's hockey internationally. The fact that they can train and play and live as hockey players, and it's not just a side gig. Oh, yeah, this is my hustle and this is my hockey career and all juggling so many different things. It's just going to improve hockey all over on the women's side of things. And I think you started to see that at the World Championships the past couple of weeks.
I totally agree. When you can be full-time athlete, that is a lot different than being part-time athlete. Yeah. The other thing that I'm glad you brought up was how the game was officiated, because that's what I was really curious about. Because
the Poulin call, because sorry, that's not a call. It's just two players colliding.
Yeah.
One is just stronger than the other.
They do that in the NHL where there's full contact all the time. There's calls that are ridiculous. But I'm glad you brought that up, because that was the one thing I was most curious about, was we've seen how the PWHL is officiated.
Yep.
And I wondered how it was going to bleed into international play. Because when on the men's side, we've seen it. The men's side is officiated totally differently.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And the women's game, because it was kind of the same when you saw, you know, in the different domestic leagues, it was kind of the same as international play.
Mm-hmm.
Now that the PWHL is around and we've seen how that game has been officiated, big difference. Big difference.
Huge. And that's the one thing that, you know, at the World Championships, and I'm sure, you know, Rick Nash, general manager for Team Canada, is telling all the players, like, there is a different standard there. There is the don't hit too hard. You can hit, but just don't hit too hard. The moment that really hit home with me, Maddie, I think it was a Dion Phaneuf on Radoslav Oleš. I don't know if you remember that. It was just a crunching, but clean, based on the standards that we're used to in North America, but by AHF standards, like, you're sitting.
Yeah, there are times in international hockey where if you hit a guy too hard, you get a penalty. And I just look at him and go, oh, boy, let's not do that.
Okay, one thing I want to make sure we get on the show today, because I want to say something about it.
Mm-mm.
Buffalo and Tampa tonight. Oh, man. When's the last time Eric Comrie played for the Buffalo Sabres?
Now, let me check. Hold on.
Ukko Pekka Luukkonen has been outstanding for them.
Do you have a guess, by the way, as to the last time he played?
Devin, do I have a guess? I want to say he hasn't played since early March.
That's a very, very accurate guess, Jeffrey.
What is it?
It is March 7th.
That was Eric Comrie's last game?
A 4-2 loss against the Nashville Predators.
So that was the last time we saw Eric Comrie in net for the Buffalo Sabres.
Yeah, and the time prior to that was February 15th. And the time prior to that was December 5th. So he has three games since December 5th. You can even go back and say four games since December 2nd in the NHL.
So he went from someone that they were too scared to waive for fear of losing him to someone they just refused to play.
And now you're saying, officer, I'd like to report a murder in Tampa Bay, because they're just throwing this guy to the wolves right now.
Eric Comrie gets a start for the Buffalo Sabres tonight.
This has to be like Devin Levi. We know you're going to Rochester. We're just going to keep you away. Ukko Pekka Luukkonen, you've taken your shots. Here you go, Eric Comrie. You're a free agent. Good luck.
I wonder what you're thinking if you're Eric Comrie. I mean, I wonder what you're thinking if you're Eric Comrie through this entire season with the Buffalo Sabres. But nonetheless, here you go. It's the empty calorie game. Yeah, get in there, kid.
Does Eric Comrie do the kid? I think it was in high school hockey in Minnesota. He took the puck, turned around, shot in his own net, took his stuff off, and walked off the ice. That would be the ultimate retirement.
Could you imagine?
That would be the ultimate retirement.
Takes off his skates and leaves him at center ice. By the way,
that's your favorite thing.
That is my favorite. And that is ripped totally out of the pages of Olympic weightlifting and Olympic wrestling. That when you're retired, you leave your shoes on the mat and you walk off. And it's a great visual.
But the ice is cold.
Yeah, I get that. But still, like, wouldn't you love to see, like, someone's going to do it one day. when it's their last game, when it's their retirement game and everyone knows, like, that's it, that they take off their skates, leave the skates at center ice. Just think about the picture. Just think about the visual.
But doesn't it have to be a character, though?
Leave your skates at center ice and walk off.
Yeah. It has to be a character.
That would be a great way to call it a career, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Like, that last game would be a good one. Trevor Linden. When Linden retired, it was a game against the Calgary Flames. Remember? And, was it Linden? Yeah, and he walked off, and Jerome McGinley had all the Calgary Flames players come back out on the ice to shake his hand. Mm. Would it not have been great to see Trevor Linden take off his skates and leave them at center ice and walk off the ice? Like, let me give you another one. Marc-Andre Fleury.
Oh, that's too much work with the pads, though.
Leave the gloves.
Okay, just gloves.
Leave something.
That's fine.
If you're a goaltender, leave something in the crease.
How about if you're a player, because the skates will almost never happen. Helmet, gloves, stick, center ice.
No, it's got to be skates. It's got to be skates.
I'm having a hard time.
You're just thinking about
how cold
it's going to be cold. The 15 steps you have to take off the ice.
It's also ridiculous. It's like, you know what I'm thinking of in my head visually?
What's that?
Is when you're a kid and you come to the ring fully dressed without your skates on. That's my visual right now. As I'm trudging along with my full gear on and my socks. It's like, oh, what about the guys that don't wear socks? Do guys still do that anymore?
Not that I've seen. That's the old Bobby Orr style, right? And for the longest time,
longest time too.
Did you? I could never. Yeah. I tried it a few times. I hated it.
Yeah, no. You know what I hated? It's just, I was like, oh, these socks are so gross after. And then, you know.
Well, they do have like proper sock wear.
Well, now, compression now socks. Yeah. Well, Jeff, this was.
No, I know.
20 plus years ago.
I understand.
I'm not that young anymore.
No, I understand.
But now the thought of not wearing socks is like, don't do that. It's weird.
I'm sure this has happened before. We've just never seen it at the NHL or pro level. Well, yeah, not to belabor it too much.
We had like Wyatt Russell on. Kurt Russell's
kid, yeah.
Yeah, we had him on, and he talked about, like, his last game, he did take off his pads, and he gave it to somebody in the stands. Because he didn't think he was coming back.
He was coming back,
It wasn't a thought that, like, I'm retiring. He just gave his pads to somebody and said, I just don't want to ship him back home. I don't want to pay for it.
You know, I'll tell you a funny story.
I think he can afford it now.
David Griffiths used to be one of the media relations guys with the Toronto Maple Leafs. Great guy, stone cold.
Okay.
And I remember one year, it was like $120,000 worth of suits from Alex McGillney because McGillney didn't want to take him back home to Russia.
That's pretty good.
I remember talking to him, he's like, dude, I just got like a $100,000 bonus. I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, Alex McGillney gave me all his suits. I thought, wow, what a fantastic thing to do. And it's just, well, no, McGillney didn't want to take the suits back to Russia, but that's fine.
He was a nice guy because he didn't just give them away to anybody, but it's like, yeah, I just didn't want them. So here, you take my problem. My $120,000 problem. How about a car, Alex? How about a $120,000 car? Can we exchange that?
I miss McGillney. McGillney refused to fly back to North America for the NHL awards because he didn't want to accept the Lady Bing.
I mean, I get why. He was never going to win the MVP. Even scoring 76 goals, he wasn't winning the MVP.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting how that happens, eh?
Still,
that he's not in the Hall of Fame. But anyway.
Still. By the way, you know, Elliot and I were talking about this at the beginning of the program. We got a hustle here. Jesse Granger on the other side. Again, I've been banging this drum. I think you're on the same page about this one. When it comes to the voting, and man, I'm going to have a tough time by Friday. I mentioned in my notes on sportsnet.ca yesterday, if you ask me who I'm putting down number one for the Hart Trophy, make sure you ask me 5 minutes later.
Yeah.
Because that's how often it changes. But those are all made public, and I think rightfully so, full transparency, who you're voting for, and et cetera. I've always maintained the Hockey Hall of Fame should do the same thing.
Absolutely.
Because we've known how grudges have played out for a lot of years and how people have been kept out of the Hockey Hall of Fame because of grudges.
Mm-hmm.
That I really do think that we should be able to see how the voting, and I think we'll get there one day. I don't think it's going to happen with this group, but somewhere, someday down the road. I mean, other sports do it. Why not hockey?
Yeah. The other thing is too, is how egregious do your faults off the ice have to be to keep you out when some of the people that are already in there are pretty bad and have gone to jail?
Yeah,
that's another conversation.
Well, hockey has always been the sport, and this is true going back to the origins of the sport, really back in 1917. Hockey has always been the one sport when you look at its counter sports or other sports, baseball, football, basketball, etc. Hockey has always been the one sport where the owners have gone to prison more than the players. If you look at the history of this game, Maddie.
It's true.
Who's gone to prison more, owners or players? I'll wait.
Yeah.
It's the owners.
Yeah.
Unique to hockey. All right, we'll hit a break on that lovely note. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Vegas Golden Knights. Jesse Granger stops by. How are you liking Tomas Hertl with the Vegas Golden Knights? He looks good, eh?
Pretty good.
How you like that tip in front of the net in the OT yesterday against Colorado, Maddie?
Stunned that he was in front of the net.
I know. I love him. Vegas looks good, but questions about Alex Pietrangelo. Will he be available for the Vegas Golden Knights in round one? All these things up for grabs. Jesse Granger, who covers the Vegas Golden Knights for The Athletic, joins us next. The Merrick Show continues across the Sportsnet Radio Network, simulcast on Sportsnet 360, and wherever you get your podcasts. Back in a moment.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Oh, Matt Marchese, we get tweets. From Bingo Hank. Leave your skates at center ice. Most ridiculous thing I have heard. I take offense to that. I've said way more.
Yeah, he hasn't listened to this show long enough.
Stick around. Or watched it. Stick around. It gets
my mustache is way more ridiculous than that statement.
You know why your mustache pops?
Because it's really dark.
Salt and pepper on the side.
Yeah, and people think I diet.
Legit. You do diet.
No, I don't.
Oh, stop.
I swear, I don't.
Why? Pretend there's no microphone there. Like, why are you lying to me?
I do not dye this. Seriously. That would be a mistake.
You totally dip that mustache.
No, look. I do not. Ugh.
All right. On that lovely note, playoff beers are coming, folks. Playoffs getting underway this weekend. Jesse Granger from The Athletic joins me now to talk about, can the Vegas Golden Knights repeat, and if so, how? Jesse, thanks so much for stopping by. How are you today?
I'm great. How are you guys?
We're doing good. So I want to get to the Mark Stone thing here. But to me, the Mark Stone issue isn't for Vegas because nothing's changing with LTIR and how it's used. I think the bigger story here is Alex Pietrangelo going to be ready for the first round? Do you think that this Stone nonsense is sort of shading what is maybe the bigger story here?
They're both really big stories. Obviously, I think they're probably the two most important players on this team. So the fact that there are questions surrounding both doesn't bode all that well for Vegas, but we'll see what they look like when they get on the ice. The Pietrangelo situation is a really odd one. He has missed, I want to say it's 10 of the last 12 games, but he did play two games there in the middle of that. And he's been ruled out with an illness is what the team is calling it. And it's just the whole situation has been very odd. Cassidy said that the last time we spoke with Coach Bruce Cassidy, he said that Pietrangelo is waiting the amount of time he needs to before he can be reengaged with the team. But he has been around the facility. He hasn't been on the ice. He has not skated, but he has been around the facility. So it is an odd situation. It's tough to predict what is going to happen when the playoffs start. My gut tells me that this isn't a case of Pietrangelo just like kind of biding his time and saying, well, these games don't mean that much. I'm going to wait for the playoffs and make sure I'm 100% ready. I think if Pietrangelo could play in these regular season games, he would be playing in them. So that, I guess, makes you lean a little more towards maybe he won't be ready for the playoffs, but you never know. With something like an illness like this, it's not like a typical injury where we can have a solid timeline. So if he can't play, it's obviously a huge impact to the Golden Knights. I mean, he takes up so many minutes, the toughest minutes for them. So it's going to be something to watch. I agree with you. Maybe it deserves a little more attention while everyone's paying attention to the LTIR with Mark Stone.
Right. I think that, if you said, pick one player that Vegas can't win without, Pietrangelo's my guy. With all due respect to Jack Eichel, Jonathan Marchessault, et cetera, Mark Stone, the one guy that I look at with the Vegas Golden Knights is that you cannot afford to take this guy out of the lineup based on, not just him, but, the entire defense last year, but all that's led by Alex Pietrangelo. He's the one guy you can't have on the sidelines. I mean, I guess you could still do some damage in the playoffs, but go as long as Vegas hopes to go without Alex Pietrangelo. Jesse, call me skeptical.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think Noah Hanifin, the addition of Noah Hanifin makes it a little easier. I think they're a little, they've been better equipped to deal with missing him than they were prior to Hanifin, because Hanifin comes in and takes all those minutes, right? Yeah. He's been playing that top pair and he's been playing it well. But you get Pietrangelo back and now you can mix those. And I don't know how they're going to set the pairings up if Pietrangelo comes back, but it is possible for them to have Alex Pietrangelo, Noah Hanifin, or Shea Theodore on the ice at all times. They're probably going to have one of them on each pair, which sounds like a nightmare to play against. So, yeah, it's a big difference when you throw Pietrangelo in there.
Let me ask you about Hanifin there. And we were all expecting, at the deadline or around the deadline, him to go to Tampa Bay. We know that was the preferred destination. And then we thought, okay, so Vegas has got him as a rental, and then he'll make his way somehow to Tampa in the offseason. Was it George McPhee? Was it Kelly McCrimmon? Was it the city itself? Like, what sold Noah Hanifin on Vegas?
I think it's a little bit of everything. I'll say I was probably in the minority. When they traded for Hanifin, I think I said it that day, I'd be shocked if he doesn't re-sign here, just because the Golden Knights have always done it. Like, they do not pay for rentals. They've had a few rentals, but it's kind of ancillary guys. Like, Anthony Mantha is a good example. They traded for him.
Yep.
He probably is a true rental, but they didn't give up a lot for him. They did give up a lot for Hanifin. And typically with this team, that's what they've done, is they've re-signed these guys very quickly. Mark Stone was very similar. They signed him to an extension right after trading for him at the deadline. They did it with Robin Leonard. They've done it several times. So I expected Hanifin to re-sign at some point. I think that for Hanifin, in terms of from his side, why pick Vegas? Why not hit the open market? Well, for one, you get the eighth year, which is helpful. Yeah. For two, you get, and this would have been the same case in Florida, but the no state tax in Nevada makes it easy to, you're bringing home a little more of that percentage that you're signing, that $7.3
million. Yep.
And then the other thing about it is I just think he likes the city. He likes the team a lot. He's really close friends with Jack Eichel. They've known each other for a long time, so I think that helps. Mm-hmm. He's integrated into this team really well, and they're winning. It had been a while since he'd won in Calgary.
Right.
I think going into the playoffs, you get into an environment, the defending cup champs, you see the owner willing to spend whatever it takes. You see the general managers making aggressive moves to try to win. I think there's a lot to like about the city of Las Vegas, and you have a team that you're maybe not, it's hard to predict who's going to win every year, but you know the team is going to try to win and do everything they can to win, and I think that goes a long way.
I do wonder, you know, the Vegas charm offensive, like, I'm continually impressed at how, you know, when Kelly McCrimmon identifies, and we saw this last year with Ivan Barbashev, and then Barbashev extended, like, the charm offensive that Vegas can turn on is, I mean, it's got to be tough to resist, for one, because, you know, obviously the players, it seems like whatever Kelly McCrimmon wants, Kelly McCrimmon gets. And then it seems as if, I was talking to Elliot about this on the podcast a couple of shows ago, it seems like the way that Vegas does business is, you know, we don't mind making it messy during the year. We don't mind, you know, ruffling feathers. We don't mind, you know, leaving a messy bed as we walk out the front door. It doesn't matter because we're going to clean everything up in the off season. Where other teams want to keep things nice and tidy all the way through the season, Vegas doesn't care. Like, yeah, you know what? We're going to dent some cars parking, but whatever. We'll get them fixed in the off season. Like, that seems to be, and it's so sane to do it that way. Like, they have, like, the season where they're going to make it messy and do whatever it takes to win and bruise some egos and bruise some cars and leave some dents, and then they'll just clean it all up in the summer. I just don't know why more teams don't follow that philosophy. To me, it makes the most sense. That's how you should run your team. Agree, disagree?
I totally agree with you. I think it's a combination of but I also don't think it works everywhere. I don't know if this strategy can work in Winnipeg or Columbus or Arizona. I think that they take a lot of risks, like in terms of the Hanifin trade. You'd give up all that. If you don't go on a playoff run and Hanifin leaves, that's a disaster of a trade. Yeah. But they make it with the confidence of this player will re-sign here. We don't have a contract yet, but we are very confident that every player that's ever come in here wants to stay. So we want to keep, if we want to keep them, that's an option. I think in maybe some other markets, that's not as easy to do, but they deserve the credit for being aggressive. And it's the same thing with the LTIR stuff, because the one thing that I feel like never gets discussed is, okay, Mark Stone gets injured. You realize you're not going to have him for the rest of the regular season. So they go out and they spend basically not just Mark Stone's salary, but actually more than that if you account for all the salaries that were retained and they filtered them through guys. They bring in all this salary. Well, like you said, it's that messes things up. In the offseason, you've got something to clean up. And I think not a lot of GMs are not willing to put themselves in the position where we're going to be over the cap heading into the offseason and we're going to have to trade someone. They did it with Riley Smith last offseason. They did it with Marc-Andre Fleury the year before that. They did it with Max Pacioretty the year before that. You have to be willing to put yourself in a tough spot in the offseason with more salary than you can hold in order to take advantage of the LTIR the way the Golden Knights have. So, yes, I agree. I think there are a lot of circumstances that help them, but I think they deserve tons of credit for being as aggressive as they've been in every situation they get into.
It feels like the answer to this is yes, but you're there, so I'll ask you. Does this mean that players like Jonathan Marchessault, who's having a tremendous year again, and players like Chandler Stephenson just flat out won't be back next year?
Well, the money, I mean, if you do the math, it says they're gone. But this team finds a way of making room for players they want to keep. It looked like Barbashev, they weren't going to have money to keep him last year. And yet they traded Riley Smith, a player that pretty much no one expected to go, in order to make room for Barbashev. So, yes, I think right now it looks like those two are more likely gone than not, but I could easily see them making a trade to make room for Marchessault. I think with Stephenson, it's going to be tough just because when they added Hurdle, that's another center, a team that already has more centers than they need. I mean, this team is stacked at center. And then you add another one in Hurdle with the term that he has with 6 years still left on that deal. To me, that kind of signaled this might be the last year in Vegas for Chandler Stephenson just because of that. There's still a chance, but I think he's more likely gone. Marchessault, I could see them finding a way. Like I said, I still think it's probably the favorite that they don't keep him, but I see them finding a way to keep Marchessault if they really want to.
Okay. Got a couple of minutes here. The Mark Stone question. I look at this and say people can complain about it all they want. We saw this with Patrick Kane. We saw this with Nikita Kucherov. And quite bluntly, we've already seen this from Mark Stone. But right now, there doesn't seem to be an appetite from either side of the fence here to open up the CBA and do something about it. Like, okay, if you don't play game 82, you can't play game 83. It seems like there is no appetite to change this. Players don't want to change it. It doesn't seem like the teams want to change this. Is this just something for people to be upset about, but there is no solution that can come out of it until it's CBA negotiation time?
Right. Yeah, that seems to be the case to me. I mean, you could do the thing like you said about you have to play 82 to play the first game of the playoffs. You could just make you can't ice a roster, a lineup in the playoffs that's over the cap. They could make all these rules, but like you said, the reality is they haven't. And as the rules are currently the way they are, Kelly McCrimmon is playing within the rules, and I don't see what people would expect him to do.
Yeah.
If Mark Stone lacerates his spleen like he did, and he's expected to be out for the rest of the regular season, should Kelly McCrimmon sit on all that available cap space and not make his team better? That would seem like, I think we'd all be saying he's doing a poor job of managing the team if he did that. So I don't know what people want Kelly McCrimmon to do in that situation. I understand why people are upset. The timing of it being so similar to last year, I totally understand. I'm not sitting here wondering why everyone's upset. I get that. But I also would turn it to people that are upset and say, what should Kelly McCrimmon have done in this situation when he knows $9.5 million is going to be out of his lineup? Why wouldn't he use that? That would be not managing his team the best of his ability. So it's a tough spot.
Last one for you. Vegas, the defending Stanley Cup champions, as we all know. Does everything need to go perfect for them to win again? Like, I look at the Western Conference, Jesse. It's a monster. Like, there's nobody that I'd want to play. Like, if you do the, you can choose your opponent game, I don't know if there's anybody in the Western Conference that I look at and say, like, yeah, I want to play that team. I mean, in the East, you could probably look at third in the Metropolitan. You can look at wild card two and say, hey, if I'm picking, give me one of those two. You can't do that in the Western Conference. Essentially, it's a long-winded way of me asking you, if Vegas is going to do this again, how are they going to do this again when, you know, last year it was the East that loaded up a trade deadline and got really competitive, and the opposite happened this year. Everybody went from the East to the West. If Vegas is going to do it, Jesse, how?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. It seems like everything's got to go perfect for them, but you could probably say that about all the teams in the West because of how good the West is. Like the Avs, if they're going to make it out, everything's got to go right. Edmonton, Vancouver, whoever, Winnipeg, Dallas, whoever you want to pick. Mm-hmm. I think for this team, there is, I see the route to the Cup final for this team. I've seen them play that style of hockey for stretches, and it's the it's what they did last year in the playoffs. They use their big blue liners, their big defensemen, and they have such good defensive minded forwards like William Karlsson and Mark Stone, and Jack Eichel's become phenomenal defensively. When they lock down that end of the ice and you just cannot get to the middle of the ice, it makes the job easy on their goalies. The goalies haven't been as good this year, but I don't think it's necessarily that the goalies aren't playing as well. It's that the team is not making it as easy on them as they did last year, I think. And we've seen it for stretches this year, but they just haven't been able to do it consistently for more than a week at a time. And that's the concern. So if I'm a betting man, are they going to put it together for a long enough stretch to win it all again? I think the odds say no, but we have watched them do it. We watched them do it for 2 months last summer. So yeah. I think there definitely is a possibility this team puts it all together and plays. They're about as healthy as they've been right now, which is a huge key to that. If Petrangelo's himself, if Mark Stone eventually comes back and is himself, I see a route for this team to repeat. But with how good the West is, with how consistent they're going to have to be to get out of that, there are, like you said, there are no easy matchups. You're going to have to be at your best every series all the way through. It seems unlikely that they're going to be able to put it together, but this is a group of dudes with a bunch of Stanley Cups. They've done this before. I wouldn't put it past them.
I just hope if they do it, that Mark Stone, after the final game with the Stanley Cup beside him, has a Nikita Kucherov-style T-shirt about being over the salary cap. That, to me, would just be chef's kiss. Jesse, you're great. As always, thanks so much for stopping by and talking to me today. Much appreciated.
Love coming on. Thanks for having me.
There he is, Jesse Granger from The Athletic, covering off the Vegas Golden Knights. Maddie, do you care about the Mark Stone question and how they use LTIR and what they're doing? And I look at it as that's a general manager using all things available to him.
Yeah, and it's not even like if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying, because he's playing within the rules. Who cares? Yeah. Like, people need to get over this because it's not changing right now.
2 years.
Take advantage of it while you can.
CBA issue.
Yep.
Do it. Is it going to change? A, there doesn't seem like there's any appetite, but if it does, 2 years.
Yeah.
Thanks to Jesse Granger, Aaron Ambrose, Jim Nill, Dallas Stars General Manager, and Elliot Friedman for stopping by today. Maddie, as always, thank you. Thanks to Lance Kennedy and the returning Jen Rolnick back from vacation in Portugal, the land of the lemon trees and the cork and the diving dogs. She's returned. And the Merrick Show will return tomorrow, noon Eastern, across the Sportsnet Radio Network, Sportsnet 360, wherever you get your podcasts. We'll talk to you tomorrow.